tonight is from the second book of Samuel and chapter 23. The second book of Samuel, chapter 23. Verse number 1, the heading at the commencement of the chapter tells us, "Now these be the last words of David." And then a further heading at verse 8. "These be the names of the mighty men whom David had, the Tachmonite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains. The same was Adino the Esnite. He lifted up his spear against 800, whom he slew at one time. And after him was Eliezer, the son of Dodo the Ahoite, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines that were there gathered together to battle. And the men of Israel were gone away. And he arose and smote the Philistines until his hand was weary, and his hand clave unto the sword. And the Lord wrought a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to spoil. And after him was Shammah, the son of Agi the Hararite, and the Philistines were gathered together in a troop, where was a piece of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it, and slew the Philistines, and the Lord wrought a great victory. And 3 of the 30 chief went down, and came to David in the harvest time, unto the cave of Adullam, and the troop of the Philistines pitched in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in an hold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David longed and said, Oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. And the three mighty men brake through the host of the Philistines, and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it, and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink thereof, but poured it out unto the Lord. And he said, Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is not this the blood of the men that went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things did these three mighty men." And you notice a long list of names at the end of the chapter, and the very last words of the chapter says 37 in all. Now that will do for our reading from the scriptures. Again, most of you are aware that we are taking a look in these meetings at some of the triplets, or more specifically, some of the threesomes that we have in Holy Scripture. If we just thought of triplets, of course, there are so many of them, it would be impossible to even make a start at covering the ground. But I mentioned last night that only are seven different groups in Holy Scripture described by these two words, these three. And we will endeavour, with the help of the Lord and in His will, in the five nights of the meetings, to consider five of those groups described as these three. We've already thought about three in a city from Ezekiel 14, Noah and Daniel and Job, three men in a city. And you know that last night we thought about three in a family, these three in one of the most famous families that this world has ever seen, Moses and Aaron and Miriam. And now tonight, as you can see very, very clearly, we have read here from the end of verse number 17, these things did these three mighty men, so that we will be considering tonight three in an army. Now, the tail end of the second book of Samuel is something that has given readers from time to time a little bit of difficulty. When you get through those chapters 18, 19, and 20, the Absalom rebellion has been quelled, and everything is at rest, and it seems as though the kingdom is just ready for handing over to Solomon. But you don't read about the handing over until you get to the first book of Kings, chapters 1 and 2. And in the final books, the final chapters of 2 Samuel, instead of carrying the story forward, for some reason or another, there seems to be a switch backward. That is from chapters 21 through to chapter 24. Now, I think in the local paper there sometimes with us, the Lurgan Mail, they have maybe about December, they would have a couple of pages in the middle of the paper, and they would take some of what they reckon are the best full pictures throughout the previous months, and just before the year would end, they would give you a review of some of the special events of the year. Now that's the kind of thing that happens at the end of 2 Samuel. For four chapters, we have a number of items mentioned. They're not in chronological order, but we are given a review of things that took place at different periods in the reign of David. Now there are six stories, or six sections, in the end of that chapter. I just mention this for the interest of those who will maybe study the book a little bit more. Remember, this part of the book is the review of David's reign. We have the rise of his reign, the righteousness of his reign, the rebellion in his reign. I'm not going over that. That's the early part of 2 Samuel. But these chapters are David's reign in review. So that in these chapters, of course, we would expect to find great lessons about the review. You see, there is a review coming. Not only was David's reign reviewed, but according to the New Testament, our lives will be reviewed. And in light of that coming review, the principles of these chapters are very, very instructive. The first section has to do with David's wisdom. Way back at the beginning of chapter 1, you have a section there that tells us about a problem that came up. I'm not even going to mention what the problem was in detail. The problem came up, and David dealt with it in a very, very wise way. Then the second section has to do with David's war. You get a list of his wars, and some of the giants that he killed, and some of the men that helped him, David's wars. Then in chapter 22, the third section is a great, big, long psalm of David's worship. When you get to the beginning of chapter 23, the fifth section is David's last word. Then the fifth section which we read tonight, David's warrior. And then of course the last section, chapter 24, where David committed an awful wrong and he numbered the people. His wisdom, his wars, his worship, his words, his warriors, and his law. Well, you say, so what? What difference does it make? Well, you see, in that very, very last section, what I said about David's law, David says, Lord, I have sinned, and I have done foolishly. So if in the first section we get David's wisdom, in the last section we get David's folly. That's number one and number six. Number two, David's wars. Number five, David's warrior. Number three and four in the middle are two poems. One poem is David's worship. The other poem is David's last words. So I'm just mentioning that some of you will have as much interest in that as you have in cobwebs and spiders, but others of you will be a little bit more interested, and those who want to take, you know, things in the Bible are not haphazard, and there is a beautiful parallelism exhibited in the arrangement of the stories in these last two chapters. The two outside stories tell us about divine government, because God sent a famine in the first story and God sent a plague in the last story. The two next stories tell us about human gallantry, David's wars and David's warriors. And the two middle stories tell us about divine grace, divine government on the outside, divine grace in the middle, and human gallantry in the central section on either side. That's how the kingdom goes on. That's how the work of God goes on still. There is divine government, there is divine grace, and there is human commitment the blend of the divine and the human, but I can't follow that through very, very much more just at the minute. Just, I want to mention that because it shows us exactly where this passage is located in the book of Samuel. Now, chapter 23, as you know, as I've already said, the first seven verses deal with David's last words. From verse 8 to 39, give us a precious, profitable list of David's loyal warriors. And it is that section that we will be looking at least a little part of it, tonight in the meeting. These be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The one thing that surprises me about this honours list is that the number is quite small, just 37. Just 37. Out of all the thousands of warriors that must have passed across the stage of Israelite history in the lifetime of David, there are just 37 that find a place on the honours list in this final review, and only 37 who are categorised as the mighty men whom David had. It strikes me as a surprising small number, and yet when we take a look at some of the things that are said about these men in this chapter, isn't it amazing to us, brethren and sisters, that such a small group of men were able to accomplish so much? It makes me feel that as far as these men were concerned, the quality of the men must have been a good bit more important than the quantity. I reckon that these 37 men, because of their caliber, and because of their character, and because of their commitment, these 37 men accomplished more than 370 men of a different kind could accomplish. Sometimes we become discouraged if an assembly becomes small. It's almost impossible for us, in the society in which we live, not to buy into the philosophy of the world that big is better and biggest is best. Man thinks big, and he organizes big, and he has to be big. The tenor of the Bible is the contradiction of that philosophy. Here we're, the strength of an assembly does not depend upon its size. I would far rather have an assembly with a dozen who are absolutely committed than an assembly with 70 who are half-hearted. D.L. Moody said, give me one man who can say like the Apostle Paul, this one thing I do. And he said, I'll not worry about 100 men who have to say, these 50 things I dabble at. Now these men knew what they were about. And they knew what they were doing. And they knew what they were aiming at. And it wasn't so much their number, it was their nature. These be the mighty men whom David had. Actually, that was the secret. That's what gave these men their strength. That's what gave these men the nature of mighty men. It says these were the men whom David had. And I can just say he had them. He had them. I want you to tell me, how much of these men did David have? He had their heads. He had their feet. He had their hands. And best of all, he had their heart. And he had them all. These men became mighty men because they had given themselves unreservedly with a total consecration to God's King. And they saw the kingdom advancing. I suppose it wouldn't be amiss for me to stop just for a minute before I go any further in the meeting. How much of us does Christ have? How much of you does he have? Does he have half of your heart?
Less than half. Does he have 80%?
These men were 100%. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. You know, one of the things that made these men mighty and distinctive in the nation at that time was that their companionship with David seemed to make them like him. He was described as a mighty man as far away back as the first book of Samuel, chapter 16. And he who himself was a mighty man, before he died, he had around him a cluster of other mighty men. You know, it takes a leader to produce a leader. A pygmy makes pygmies. And a man of compromise produces men of compromise. You see, Saul was a big man. And when Saul died, the army was scattered. Saul was a big man, but he wasn't a mighty man. Saul had the size and the physique, but he didn't have the soul of a mighty man. David reproduced himself in these particular men. There's a lovely verse in the other list given of these men in the first book of Chronicles, and I just leave a question, for I haven't time to deal with it or answer it just now in the meeting. Whenever you find a thing repeated in the Bible, you always open your eyes 0.5 of a millimeter, and you take an extra look, and you say, well, now God is not like the preachers. The preachers have to say it over again when they are stuck. But if God says a thing the second time, he says it with significance. Now, we have the reign of David in the second book of Samuel, and we have the reign of David in the first book of Chronicles. So his reign is given to us twice. There are quite a number of differences. And one of the big differences is this. In the first book of Chronicles, the list of the mighty men is given at the first. In the second book of Samuel, the list of the mighty men is given right at the end. Why the difference? Well, your guess is as good as mine, and you can tell me what your guess is when we're going out at the door. But the Bible doesn't just duplicate things, and when there is a duplication, in a sense, with a difference, we do well to notice just what it says. But there is that verse in 1 Chronicles chapter 11. It says, these be the names of the mighty men who made themselves strong with David in his kingdom. They made themselves strong with David in his kingdom, says our authorized version. Now, I'm very partial just in that particular passage to the rendering of the New American Standard Bible. Don't follow it in everything, but I follow it in many things. And in that particular verse, this is what they say. These be the names of the men who gave David strong support in his kingdom. That is, when David was seeing the kingdom established, and when David was seeing the kingdom expanded, behind and underneath that man, there was a body of men, and they gave him unflinching loyalty. They gave him strong support. When David came to the throne, the kingdom of Israel was a postage stamp. When David's day was done, what began with him as a postage stamp kingdom had become, in the terms of those days, had become an international empire. And the men that helped to see the thing move along were a number of men, and the Bible says they gave David strong support in his kingdom, and it's no wonder the Bible calls them mighty men. Recently, a brother who has preached about, I would say, well, nearly four times as much as I have, so I'll not mention his name, but that will give you, he has served the Lord admirably in this country and in other parts. He said to me with concern, he says, David, if the Lord be not come, and he says, if you're still about, he said, there's a fair little bit of work to do. He said, I'm finished. But he said, I'm departing with a heavy heart.
And he said, I want to ask you a question. He says, why is it that we are dwindling? Why are we dwindling?
I couldn't give him any answer. I said, have you thought about it? He said, I have thought about it. He said, I cannot give any clear answer. But he said, I would stagger one thing. Commitment. He said, we are now seeing a generation of people and they are not as committed to the assembly as a previous generation were. If they come to the meetings, all right. If they can't come, all right. If the thing goes well, all right. If it doesn't go well, all right. He said, we're lacking the commitment. He said, we're committed to our careers. And he said, we're deeply committed to our businesses. And he said, we are very, very deeply committed to our families. And he says, many of those things are commendable. But he says, the channels of commitment which we have given to those other things have left us that God's things in measure have been wrong. Now that's what helped these men. I said already, these men were not part-timers. I'm not talking about full-time work. These men were not fifth columnists. These men gave strong support to David and their kingdom. And they were totally committed to the cause of God's anointed king. And they lived to see the thing expanding. They were just a small nucleus. But the influence and the impact of this small number on the kingdom was absolutely unbelievable. The Bible gives us great encouragement, brethren and sisters. I do repeat this without apology. It gives us great encouragement for small groups that are committed, for there's no knowing what the Lord can do with those. Now, as far as the names of these men are concerned, of course, they're very interesting. I talked about their nature, I've talked about their number, I've talked about the necessity. The kingdom needed these men. They were the backbone of it. Mighty men. Mighty men. You know, assemblies still need mighty men. I'm not talking about severe men. But I am talking about strong men. I'm not talking about harsh men. But I am speaking about men of conviction. They give the assembly stability and strength. And these men were the backbone of the power of the country. Their names are mentioned. You know, the Lord is interested in people. He doesn't just tell us that David had 37 mighty men full stop. But he takes the time, the Holy Spirit takes the time to list them one by one. The recognition of these men was individual. And you know, in a coming day, in the review that I've been referring to, in the coming day, every single sacrifice of every saint will be noted one by one. Now, that brings me to a difficulty, which brings me very close to what I want to speak about tonight. I have to take just about 2 minutes and give a little bit of explanation, do a little bit of arithmetic, and then acknowledge that I'm not altogether sure. If there are 37 men in this chapter, it's not easy just to sort out the classification. Now, it seems to me, and if any of you, dear brethren, want to talk about it afterwards, for I'm sure there are some here who have studied it carefully, and it is a difficult thing, but this is my conclusion. I'm not going to take you through the process because of the clock. My conclusion is this, that there are three. They're described as the first three. Then there's a second three. Because it actually says about some of the first three, it says he didn't attain unto some of the second group, he didn't attain unto the first three. So if it talks about a first three, there must have been a second three. And then there's a group, and they are called the 30. And we have a long list of names, but when you count the names, there are actually 31 names in it. So you say, what has happened here? Well, of course, sometimes the disciples were described as the 12. Even after Judas left, they were still called the 12.
The 12 is the name for a number that was generally 12. If one dropped out, they were still called the 12. The men that translated the Old Testament Hebrew into Greek. You've heard about the Septuagint. I know you have. It's called the Septuagint because Septuaginta is the Latin word for 70. Well, you say, does that mean that 70 men translated the Old Testament Hebrew into Greek way back in whenever it was? Well, there were actually 72. But they've got the name of the translation of the 70. So the round number was used, even though there were a couple of extras in it. I think there was a group called the 30. It has 31 names. Then there was the first three, then the second three, and unless computation has changed, 3 plus 3 plus 31 makes 37, and the end of the chapter says the 37 of them. So the 30 were the mighty. The second three, they were mightier, and the first three were the mightiest of all. The mighty, the more mighty, and the most mighty. And I tell you the truth, if I had been alive in David's day, if I had got scraped into the bottom of the last group, I wouldn't have been doing too badly. But what we are going to do tonight is to look at the top group, the mightiest. These things did these three. And I take it that the three in question are the number one three, the mightiest of David's men. Now, we have two sections about these three. We have five verses that tell us what these three men did single-handed. There's a Tekmonite, and then there's another fellow called Eliezer, and then there's another man called Shammah. And we get a little picture of things that they did at different times, their deeds. Five verses deal with their deeds. Single-handed, separate times, in different places. And then we get five verses that tell us about something which these men did together. Now I think that's a very, very important thing. Just before I go any further, I would say this. One of the features of a man, and we're including sisters in this too, in a general remark, one of the features of a person who will be able to make a good contribution to the work of God is this: they'll be able to stand on their own. Number one. But coupled with being able to stand on their own, they will also have that other beautiful feature of being able to work with their brethren. So we have both sections, what they did single-handedly and what the three men did as a threesome, as a unit. You know, there are some dear brethren, and they're wonderful, or so they say, but whatever is wrong, they just can't get on with others. They're a kind of misfits. And they're maverick. And they're loners. Now these men could operate when they were alone. They could operate when they were alone, and they could stand like stalwarts. But I tell you, they could also cooperate. You see, dear brother, don't only operate, but to bring the assembly along, you'll also have to be able to cooperate. And mind you, that's not always a big, easy business because other people are so awkward at times. Well, what about what they did on their own? You might have noticed in reading down those 10 verses, the two groups of five, that we had quite a number of different references to the Philistines. Now, this might just be a trifle, a little bit more complicated, but I do want to take time to emphasize it in the meeting. These men were absolutely clear about the enemy. You know, they weren't fighting with each other. But they were fighting against a common enemy. One man had 300 Philistines down. Another man had 800. They're not exactly described as Philistines. Another, the bunch of them together, break through the ranks of the Philistines. The Philistines seemed to be the great problem against which these men were fighting. Well, you say, I know that we have to contend earnestly for the faith. The Jude tells us that we are to be soldiers, and we are to defend, and so on. Against whom do we fight? Well, we don't fight against people.
We don't wage a battle against personality. But we do have to stand against philosophies. And we do have to stand against false principles. And we do have to stand against false doctrines. And if those false doctrines are being propagated by people, we will have to take a firm stand against those people. But the opposition will not be personal. The opposition will always be because of the propositions and the philosophies. You see, the older nations that the Israel had to encounter, you have often heard messages about them. For example, the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Moabites and all those nations that were a plague to the people of God in the Old Testament, they represent different aspects of the world. Egypt. Egypt represents the world in its independence. But they ain't got a big God. We don't need the rain. We don't work with anything bigger. Egypt is a world of pleasure that boasts of its independence of God. The Moabites were a bunch of drunkards. They had lovely vines all over their hills, and they drank and drank and drank until they drank themselves stupid. And the Moabites, sometimes the children of Israel got into problems with the Moabites. The Moabites represents the world in its indulgence. What about the Babylonians? Well, the Babylonians, Babylon was the great seat of idolatry. And if Egypt is the independence of the world, and Moab and Ammon the indulgence of the world, Babylon is the idolatry of the world, and we need to watch the world in all those forms. What about the Philistines? What do they represent? Well, the Philistines are different. Now, they're different in this sense, and I try and keep it just as I skirt around the subject without going into too many details in them. The Philistines are different in the fact that they were in Egypt was down to the southwest. Babylon was up to the northeast. Moab and Ammon were across the Jordan to the east. Those other nations that I have mentioned were the world outside. But the Philistines weren't down the south, the way down to Egypt. And the Philistines weren't in Africa. And the Philistines weren't away up in the south. The Philistines were right inside the land. They were inside. Now for years, these old Philistines, they tormented. I think I can say that without exaggerating. They gave the children of Israel far more trouble for years than either the Egyptians or the Babylonians or the Moabites. Because they were working from the inside. And they were always upsetting, and they were always annoying. And that was it. Well, you see, who do they represent now? Where does our biggest problem come from, brother? Do you know, again, I don't want to exaggerate, but I would say that possibly one of the biggest threats to assembly testimony, to pure assembly testimony, comes from a large body of people who claim to be Christian, but they've never been born again. Now there is, what about the Hindu? No. What about the Muslim? Well, Islam is a big threat, but not in the sense that I'm talking about. But what about the groups that say they're Christian? And yet they're not prepared to acknowledge some of the great doctrines of the Bible. Now we need to watch that. Because they're inside. They're not pagans. They're not heathen. They're professing Christians. They're right inside. And if some of their philosophies would ever be allowed to infiltrate, and if they would be allowed to gain ground, and some of their ideas would be allowed to advance, assembly testimony would get smaller and weaker
and less and less. How did the Philistines get inside? What were they doing there? How did the Israelites get in? Well, you see, you know, I don't know, Father Master, that the Philistines got in, the Israelites got in because God brought them in. The Israelites were a bunch of slaves in the land of Egypt, and God, by his mighty hand, brought them out. He opened up the sea. He brought them through the sea. He guided them by the cloud through the wilderness. He opened up the Jordan, and the Israelites got into the land because God brought them in by his mighty power. There's no difficulty answering that question, yes. These people got in by power. How did the Philistines get in? Did God bring them in? Did the Philistines come through the Red Sea? No way. Did the Philistines come down through the Jordan? No way. Had the Philistines ever been circumcised? No way. The Bible nearly always refers to them as uncircumcised Philistines. But yet they were in. Well, as far as history would tell us, and I could prove this from the prophecy of Amos and so on, but again I'm not going to get you to turn to it because of time. The Philistines probably originated in the island of Crete. When there was a bit of a snowball fight in the island of Crete way back quite a few years ago, and the old Philistines decided we better get out of here. It's getting a bit rough. We don't like this. And they set sail and they wanted to go to the land of Egypt. And when they got to the coast of Egypt, across the Mediterranean, the old Egyptians came and said, "You're not getting in here." And they wouldn't let them off their boats. So when they couldn't get into Egypt, the next easy thing to do was just move up the coast. And they got into Palestine. Now they really wanted to go to Egypt. And they would really have been far happier in Egypt. But just because of convenience, they happened to land up in Palestine. Now, dear brothers and sisters, I can see a tremendous... You see, there's a great number of people call themselves Christians. I'm not speaking of an assembly fellowship. There may be some in assembly fellowship, but I'm talking about the broadest umbrella that you, and they call themselves Christians, but they have, it wasn't the power of God brought them in. They never knew what it was to be under the blood of the Lamb. They never knew what it was to be dead, buried, and raised with Christ. It hasn't been the power of God. They would really, they would rather be in the world. But they only take the name Christian because it's the easier option. And it's nice. And it's popular. And the Philistines in the Old Testament, they represent what the Apostle Paul described in the New Testament. He said there's a group of people and they have the form of godliness but not the power. Now the Philistines had the name, actually. In Hebrew, the name Philistine and the name Palestine are twins. Now, I could not, it's a big subject that you may want to talk about, and I'll talk about it a little bit if I can. I'm not altogether sure whether the Philistines gave the name Palestine to the land, or whether the land Palestine gave the name Philistine to the people. But one thing is sure, that they had the name. They had the name. Oh, we are Christian. Surely we are Christian. We are definitely Christian. We all worship the same God, and we belong to the same Lord Jesus, and they have the name. But they don't have the nature. They weren't circumcised. They weren't through born. They didn't come into the land by the guidance of God's cloud. They got into the land by the ease of convenient circumstance. And they were always a problem. You know, they didn't, from the Bible, they didn't have a good history. Way back in the book of Genesis, they were filling up wells. When you get to the book of Samuel, they were taking away the weapons. They wouldn't allow any smiths. There was smith, a blacksmith, as we call it. A blacksmith was the man that sharpened the sword in Israel. And they said, if we let these boys keep their swords, they'll maybe fight against us, these old Israelites. No more smiths in the land. Don't be working anymore. We want you to lose your edge. We want you to lose your water. Then the Philistines said, we want you to lose your water. And then another passage in the book of Samuel says, they were coming up and they were robbing the threshing floors. They would stop the water, they would take away the sharp edge, and then they would steal the food. The Philistines, is it any wonder these men challenged them? Is it any wonder that these men who were loyal to David said, if we are going to see this kingdom what it should be, we need to stand against these Philistines? Now they're inside. They have come in the wrong way. They have taken the wrong name. They have some very, very false ideas. And they would, even if they got the chance, they would put the very eyes out of your head. And they would cut the hair of a Nazarite. And they had plenty of Delilahs. And you know, the Philistine women, boys, I tell you, they just love to get an Israelitish husband. A Philistine girl, she thought that she had made a victory if she could just seduce one of God's noble. Can I say to any of the dear brethren here that are not married, remember, when you would be seeking a marriage companion, can I say this? Do your best to make sure that you marry someone that is a true-born Israelite and not a Philistine girl. She might have the name, but not the nature. And if you get married to her and get into her lap, she will do for you what Delilah did for Samson. And your life and your liberty will be destroyed just as Samson's was. The Philistines are very, very sinister. You see, we have a great number. Well, they say we believe in Christmas. Christmas! Christmas! A wonderful time of the year. And if you talk to those very same people, they will tell you, but we don't believe in the virgin birth of Christ. Don't believe in the virgin, but we're Christians. We're Christians! But we wouldn't believe in the virgin. You see, they've got the name, but they haven't got the power. And they love Easter. Easter! Oh, the Christian festival of Easter! Oh, what's a great... You say, what about the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead? Oh, well, they say that's an early Christian myth. But we know better now. But they celebrate the season. But they deny the power. Well, they say the book, they say the Bible. The Bible is a lovely Christian book. It's a wonderful Christian book. It's one of the treasures of literature, this beautiful Christian book, the Bible. And they say wonderful things and moral principles and very, very high teachings in the Bible. It's really a wonder. Tell me, sir, it's a wonderful book. Do you believe that the Bible is the Word of God verbally inspired? Oh, you say, don't you? That's something to believe back in the 1800s. But they're still Christians, but they don't. You see, if we let the Philistines, if we let the Philistines come in, and Philistine ideas, is it any wonder this man stood with his hand, and he took on 800 of them? And there was another man, and just a patch of barley, or a place of lentils, and he stood, and he defended it. And there's another man, and it says he defied them. See, one man defeated them, the other man defied them, and the third man defended against them. And the man that defended the patch of ground, it says he stood until his hand got stuck to the sword. If he had dropped his sword, he'd have been affixed, wouldn't it? But as long as the Philistines were coming, you say, man, have a bit of sense. You're only a lump of a field. It's not worth risking your life over. Let it go. Let it go. Far better a bit of peace of mind. Go away home and let them take a couple of acres. He said, this is God's inheritance. And he got a hold of his sword.
And he never let it go until he had guarded the whole thing. You know, dear Brennan, can I say, what we really need in 2001 would be men that have a good grasp. And they can take the sword of the Bible, not to cut their brethren to pieces. We have enough infighting. But to hold on to that sword until the philosophies of the Philistines, every philosophy has been laid low. And the God-given inheritance has been protected for his glory. These were the names of David's mighty men. You know, it's interesting, and I don't want to elaborate altogether upon too much of it. It's interesting, not only does the Bible tell us what they did, but it tells us when they did it. For example, one man did it when he was just alone. The others had gone away. The others had disappeared. And he was just left alone. He wasn't intimidated by the big crowds against him. He says, I take this with God. He said, this is God's inheritance. This is God's warfare. He said, there's a massive assault and invasion of the Philistines. He says, I'm going to stand here. There was a man did it in the harvest time. That's mentioned in the passage. What they did in harvest time. That's when it was very hot. You know, it wasn't easy in Bible days to do things when the sun was burning in harvest time. And there was another man that we didn't read about tonight, for he's not in the first three. You know, he did it when it was snowing. He killed a lion in a pit on a snowy day. I could hardly keep from preaching about him, because he's one of my favourite characters in the Bible. One group of men did it in harvest time when it was very hot. The other man was a mighty man when it was very cold. Just on a practical vein, you know, I have met brethren in assembly life, and I cherish them. I would call them, in modern terms, in our modern day, the equivalent, they're just God's mighty men. I have seen brethren were able to get things sorted out when it was hot. Have you seen it getting hot? It wasn't too hot here tonight at the start, but it's a little bit warmer now, and it's just going to be about right about 9:30. You'll all be exceedingly comfortable, so I just keep going. But you know, I'm not talking about the temperature in the air. Hot! And it was, it's a mighty man just... Then did you ever come to a meeting when it was freezing cold? You know, I believe their brethren come to meetings with snowballs in their pockets. And the way they look at you, they're really spreading icicles from the very ceiling. Benaiah conquered in a cold day. These other men conquered in a hot day. You see, some of us are great Christians when it's just nice. I could be a right good Christian myself when the meeting's going well. I'm a right one of the good brother when it's going well. And anybody can help a good meeting. But I tell you, it takes a man of caliber to help a meeting when it's going the wrong way. These be the names of David's mighty men. They were becoming like David. May God help us. Now, we have what they did alone. And I just touched that very scantily, because it's well known and it's very, very frequently touched. Well, then we have five verses to tell us what these three mighty men did on their own, but five verses to tell us what they did together. Now, you say, what's the purpose of this second set of five verses? Well, I think that this second set of five verses, when they went away down and got the water for David together as a threesome, it's giving us the secret behind the first five. Because you might ask the question, these men that defended the lentils, this man that defeated the Philistines, this other man that defied the Philistines, what was the motivation in all this? Why did these men do this? Well, as the second set of five verses tell us, that they did this just because they loved David. It wasn't because they loved fighting. Many a fellow joins the army just because he wants to get away from home.
Many a fellow joins the army just to see a bit of the world. There may be a few join the army because of loyalty to their country. But I would say in many cases, it's a different motive. Now, why do we do what we do? Why do we defend the thing? Why is it, you know, that man Shammah, if I was speaking about him and I've spoken about him elsewhere, I love his name. You know what the name Shammah means in the Bible? This is not guesswork. I have divine authority for this. Ezekiel tells us that in the final day, Jerusalem will be called Jehovah Shammah. And the Bible interprets that the Lord is there. Now, the word Shammah in Hebrew is just a little simple Hebrew adverb for there. Shammah was there. So he was there. Right in the middle. In the midst of it, says Chronicles, or maybe here, right in the middle of the patch, right there, he was there. And he did it. You know, I really give full credit to people, because there are some Christians, this will include the sisters, and the one thing you could say about them is they're always there. You come on Lord's Day morning, they'll be there. Lord's Day evening, they'll be there. Come in January, on a Wednesday night or Tuesday, whatever, they'll be there. Come in February, they'll be there. Come in March, they'll be there. Well, we get 2 weeks holidays in July. Come in August, they'll be there. October, they'll be there. There's some people, and they're not there for about 4 months. I don't know how you square that with commitment, but that'll be a problem for them. There. Some of you dear believers in Donegal Road, and in light of a crowning day that's coming by and by, you hardly ever miss a meeting. I remember hearing about an old sister, and she had very great difficulty with mobility. She could hardly make it along, and she used to be the first at the hall every night. And there was a visiting preacher, saw her, he was having a few meetings, and he saw her, and he noticed the difficulty she had, and she was the first every night. And some of the younger folks weren't there every night, and some of them came late, and I know they had commitments and all that. And he chanced before it was all over to say to this older sister, he says, how do you manage to get there? He says, you have a great problem with your legs. And he says, and she says, I'll tell you. She says, my heart gets there first. And she was there. You know, when your heart's there, this man's heart was in it, and he was just with that very special commitment. Now, as far as the three together were concerned, they were down with David in the hole, in the harvest time. Well, sure, if it's the harvest time, you need to get the corn in. And it's the harvest time, it's a busy time. It's all right, you can go to David when the harvest's over. But look after your own business first. He'll still be there. If David's in the hole, they'll go with him. They will take poverty with David rather than plenty with the harvest. You know, these men, the reason that they stood so strongly against the Philistines was because these men were loyal to David. There are some brethren, and I feel, they talk about standing for the truth. That's a good thing, I suppose. You know, some brethren stand for the truth, and you need to watch it. You need to watch standing for the truth. Some do it, and I wonder, do they just love a fight? And do some stand for the truth because they enjoy an argument? And do some people stand for the truth because they just like to be awkward? No, brother. You need to have a man standing for the truth. But that's the second thing. The first thing, he must have loyalty and love to Christ. These men fought with the Philistines because they loved David. They were with David in the old cave. The Philistines were, mind you, it wasn't a good situation. Imagine. The Philistines in the city and David in the cave. You see, what on earth has happened here?
You see, this thing's mixed up. The Philistines in the city of Bethlehem and David in the cave of Adullam. You say the whole thing's topsy-turvy.
Well, it is topsy-turvy, brethren, isn't it? Our blessed Lord has been cast out. And the enemies of the Lord seem to be in the ascendancy. That's the kind of environment that we are in. It's the kind of environment that these men were in. They had a commitment to David. The second thing that I want to say as I'm shortly closing, they didn't only have a commitment to David, but they had a closeness to David. You know, in that cave, in those hot days, there was one day David was just, he sighed out loud. He says, I'd love a drink of that water that I used to drink as a boy in Bethlehem. Now that wasn't a command. David didn't give an order. Would some of my men go and get me water? He just expressed a wish. It was just a whisper of a wish. And these men were close enough to David to catch it. Oh, he says, I wish. He says, I would just love a drink. You know the way you say on a hot day, I would just love a drink of this. And people would hardly hear it. But these men heard it. And he didn't have to tell them to do it. And he didn't have to order them. And these men went away. It was about 12.5 miles. Now you say, have a bit of sense going to 12.5 miles to get a goat skin of water. And sure, the Philistines are there. They cut their way through the ranks of the Philistines to get the water. And they came 12.5 miles back. And I tell you, when they got through the Philistines to get the water, you can be brave and fairly sure that there were plenty of old Philistines waiting on them up the road. And 12.5 miles there, 12.5 miles back, not because David told them to do it, but they knew that they were able to do this little bit extra. Just because they loved David. You know, we're living, brethren and sisters, in a day. And it's true of me. We love to give Christ the minimum. You know, so long as we're at the meetings and we're just keeping tag and we're all right and we're doing what he says. He says to preach the gospel, so we do it once a week. And he says to remember him, so we do it. And we're just, but you know, that real devotion to Christ. To give him something in a parched world that would refresh his heart. That's what these men did for David, to bring him a drink of water in the harvest time. Their commitment to David, their closeness to David, their courage for David, time and trouble counted nothing. We risk our lives. I could think about New Testament men. Paul said about Epaphras, he says, for the work of Christ he brought it, and he didn't count his own life dear. We watch ourselves. We watch ourselves. You wouldn't if you just had a sniffle. If we just had a sniffle, we wouldn't go in case we'd give the cold to somebody else. Good, you're talking. Just kidding. We're very sensitive, aren't we? Just watch yourself. No, I tell you, people in Samuel 23 and Philippians 2 and 2 Timothy 4, they were made of tougher material. That's what made the thing go on. I have to finish and say this. These three men, what about their commendation by David? David didn't drink the water. He said, this is not water. He said, this is not water. He says, this is blood. And he says, I'm going to take this and pour it out like a sacrifice to the Lord. The Lord didn't let the Israelites drink blood. He says, I regard this as the blood of these men. They have jeopardized their lives. And he says, I'll pour it out as just an oblation to the Lord whom these men serve. Dear brethren, I think it's very precious that every sacrifice, you know, when the Apostle Paul was speaking about the sacrifice of the Philippians, he used the very same language about their sacrifice in Philippians 4 as he had used about the sacrifice of Christ in Ephesians 5. He said, what my Lord did upon the cross was an offering for a sweet-smelling savour, Ephesians 5. And Paul thought so much of what the Philippians gave. And they were poor, but they gave. He says, the sacrifice that you have made in sending this gift to me, he says, it's a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savour. He lifted it to the level of Calvary.
And David lifted the sacrifice of these men
to the level of the altar, and he poured it out. Now, dear brother and sister, you dear sisters here tonight, some of you have sacrificed more than I will ever know or see. Remember, no sacrifice has been made that the Lord has not noticed, and that has not been a refreshment to his heart. These things did these three mighty men. Well, I suppose there are three of them about Donegal Road. I suppose there are three. May God multiply your number greatly, because if the Northern Ireland could get 30 of these men, just 30 of them, I believe there'll be a transformation in a very short space of time. May God give us the commitment of these ancient Hebrew heroes, shall we pray.